This is a new field that some people have coined under the name of oculomics. It's a complete new field using your eye to assess systemic and chronic diseases. And we are all for it. We think that it's a huge opportunity. It could help identify patient candidates for specific treatment, or just making sure that you have some screening and monitoring opportunities out there that are going to benefit large populations.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. There is massive potential to accelerate medical decision-making with AI. That's the mission of Icarion, a Swiss software company enabling healthcare teams to harmonize and analyze data at scale, ultimately improving patient outcomes. Today, we're joined by Carlos Soler, the CEO and co-founder of Icarion, to discuss their innovative platform and approach. I'm Alex Merwin, Head of Growth for Healthcare and Life Science Startups at AWS, and I'll be your host for this episode of the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. Carlos will share insights into Icarion's journey, from its origins as a retinal imaging AI startup called RetinEye, to evolving into a comprehensive data platform serving pharmaceutical companies, physicians, and researchers across therapeutic areas. We'll explore how Icarion is empowering stakeholders to detect diseases sooner through biomarker identification, optimize treatment decisions with curated insights, expedite clinical collaboration through efficient workflows, and accelerate drug development by aggregating learnings. Carlos will also discuss the key components of their scalable cloud platform, their focus on user experience and education, and the entrepreneurial resilience required to bring such an ambitious vision to reality. So join me as we dive into the world of accelerated medical decision-making with Carlos Soler and Icarion. Let's go. I am here with Carlos Soler, the CEO and co-founder of Icarion Health. I'm really excited for this one. We've known each other for a while. We've talked about doing this, and I'm sorry it took so long, but welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
And so, Carlos, where are you joining us from today?
So today I'm joining from the south of Switzerland, from Lausanne, just in front of the lake. I've been living here for 12 years. So Switzerland, Central Europe, very happy.
And where are you from originally?
Originally from a small city by the lake, by the sea. I'm sure you have never heard of it. It's called Barcelona in Spain. So I was living there 25 years of my life and then decided to go north. And that's when I came to Switzerland.
And so was it love or job that brought you to Switzerland or neither?
I think for me, it was more that I just wanted to see the world. Barcelona, even though it's big, it was not enough for me or for my dreams. So I came to IPFL, which is the Swiss Institute of Technology in Lausanne, in 2012, just to finish my studies. So I finished my studies here, and then I started the PhD in Switzerland. And then fast forward 12 years. So here we are, still very happy to be living in south of Switzerland, the French-speaking part.
Great. And can you tell me about Icarion and what you all do?
So Icarion is a software company. We just recently changed name. So before Icarion, we were called RetinAI. We are a software company developing software solutions to enable the right decisions sooner in healthcare. And what we do in practice is we have a cloud-based medical image and data management platform that enables you to collect data, different shapes and forms, imaging data, EHR data, even genetic data or demographics data, analyze it with a collection of AI models, either ours or third parties. And lastly, everything that you can do with it. So automation, operational efficiencies, workflows, and these type of things. So that's what we do.
Can you tell me about, so what was the origin story for RetinEye? And at what point did you decide that it made sense to rebrand? And what drove that decision?
So we have to go back a couple of years. So
we got plenty of time. Let's do it.
Yeah. So my co-founders and I, we were doing our PhDs together at the University of Bern. I was doing my PhD across multiple locations in Switzerland. And basically, we got to know each other there. And we were working in the ophthalmology space. So we were doing our PhDs in machine learning applied to medical imaging. And then it was pretty much at the same time that we were seeing this growth in the AI space, late 2014 applications in healthcare, this boom in AI technology. So we saw an opportunity to bring some of the innovation that we were doing in the lab to benefit the people that are going to basically use or are in need of this type of technology. So that's where RetinAI came to be. Back in the day, because we didn't know how large or how big the company could become, we thought that RetinAI was a perfect name, but then people tended to box us in the eye care space first, and also in the retina space, which is just one part of the eye, in the back of the eyes. It looks like a lasagna. That's where the retina lies. So then now, as the company evolves and we are seeing more applications in other therapeutic areas, as well as the rest of the eye, we had to change name. And that's what Aikirian is all about.
Can you tell me more about the underlying science behind that? So it seems like the eyes are this window into the rest of the body. I'm stealing your language. You've told that to me in private. But was there a particular moment where you knew that there was broader application beyond ophthalmology, or what triggered that initial insight?
So initially, to be very honest with you, we were just aiming at ophthalmology. We thought that the market was good enough, and we actually didn't even think too much about the market. We were just going with it. So it was more pure wish to make a change. And then actually that's the driver. And then you refine and find a business model that is going to accommodate your dream. Mm-hmm. I think that was our approach too. So we started with eye care. There is very large number of diseases, or a limited number of diseases, that are affecting a very large population. And those are the AMDs, the diabetic retinopathies of this world, geographic atrophy, which is a complication as well for a form of age-related macular degeneration, which is the leading one of the leading causes of blindness worldwide. And then as we were exploring the eyes, we were collecting an ever-growing number of disease biomarkers or anatomical biomarkers. And then your eyes are composed of multiple layers of cells. Some of them are actually directly connected to your central nervous system. Others are directly connected. The microvascularization of the retina is basically, it's going to be a sample of your cardiovascular system or your vascular system. So you have a lot of opportunities to have a peek at a very small millimetric region of your eye and basically look at the rest of the body. And I would say that around 3 or 4 years ago, we started to see some biomarkers linked to the rest of, to basically chronic and systemic disorders that were manifesting in the eyes. This is a new field that some people have coined under the name of oculomics. It's a complete new field using your eye to assess systemic and chronic diseases. And we are all for it. We think that it's a huge opportunity. It could help identify patient candidates for specific treatment, or just making sure that you have some screening and monitoring opportunities out there that are going to benefit large populations. So we did, just to make it simple, we didn't know at the beginning. We knew that the eye had a lot to offer, but as we were digging deeper, we found many opportunities. And today, neurodegenerative disorders, vascular conditions, inherited disorders, even metabolic disorders and autoimmune diseases, you can see them through the eyes. So I think that the market is posed for a disruption in the next 5 to 10 years.
So can you tell us about why retinal scanning is appealing in terms of acting as a diagnostic modality compared to any other lab that could be taken or imaging assay that could be taken? What's the relative cost of taking a high quality retinal scan compared to some other options? We'd love to learn more about that.
So there are a couple of converging spheres. So first, for instance, when you look at machines, a machine, retinal scanner or OCT scanner, is going to cost you something in between $50,000 to $100,000 US per machine. And these are actually the high end. You can even find them for a cheaper price. If you compare to the alternative of an MRI scanner, where the minimum cost is actually millions, then you have a cost opportunity, because you have a factor 10 less cost to introduce a solution that could help monitor the same type of disease. And At the same time, there is a lot of ever-increasing the engineering developments that are supporting automation. So very soon from now, and I think you already have some devices in the market that enable you to get a scan by yourself. You sit on the machine, you press a button, you put your eye, look at a cross in a screen, and it's going to take a scan of your eye in 3 seconds or less. And that's a massive gain, because if you are looking at healthcare systems that are really busy today, you have to go to the hospital. Maybe it takes an hour to travel to the hospital, queuing, going into the machine, getting prepared for the machine. That's time and cost versus the alternative of going to a pharmacy, to an optician, and getting the same type of scan and information, and you are posed to disrupt the model. So I think that on the one side, you have automation, because those devices can just press a button and they can run by themselves. Technology, so some technology such as ours that enables you to scan the eye and look for these pathological biomarkers to assess risk of presence or absence or potential risk of suffering from one of those diseases in the future. So I think the opportunity is there, and it's going to happen sooner than we believe. So there are already some opticians, medical device manufacturers that are looking at this opportunity for the next 2 to 3 years. So I'm sure the next time we talk, or you bring me to the podcast, we are going to be talking about the access to these machines already in Europe, US, and of course, the rest of the world.
Well, I can't wait for that. Let's talk about your commercialization a little bit. So I'd love to hear about, how did you win your first paid customers? And then contrast that to now, and what kind of commercial engagements you're working with, and what that journey looked like. Because you mentioned earlier that you had the scientific insight, and then you needed to work out the business model, which is very common within our space, where clearly if I solve an unmet need and I improve clinical outcomes, that will be enough to gain distribution. But time again, we learn that it simply is not. We have to think about how to fund the businesses. So we'd love to hear about that journey for you and how you won those first customers and how that's changed over time.
So I think for us, and this goes a bit together, we knew that we needed some time to figure out the business model, because there was screening, monitoring, there were different options. We even had to refine the product, and we had to do some micro pivoting along the way. So the first customer was actually one past collaborator that we had as part of our PhDs. So they got, we had the relationship from our PhDs. They saw that we were further developing opportunities around AI technology. So we did a pilot collaboration agreement with a hospital where we were helping them develop some specific AI analysis tools for some diseases in the eyes. So that was more of a consulting agreement where we were helping them to develop those models. And at the same time, we were learning which was the need. So it was a consultative sale. We have this collaboration with the hospital. We are going to develop an AI algorithm at the end that most likely is going to become a publication. For the physician, was actually an opportunity to develop themselves in that specific domain. And for us, it was an opportunity to figure out what to do, because we didn't know all these breathings between the lines. What is really the need? What is really the opportunity? So it was pretty much consulting. The first agreement, it was a consulting to support the development of an AI model. And then as we were developing that consulting, we realized that we needed better tools ourselves to manage the data that we were collecting. So we started building those tools to collect and organize the data. And that was the first seed for the discovery platform. So in solving our problems that we needed to develop the job, we actually created a solution that could deliver much more value to a larger audience. So the first problems we took care of was actually our problem to be able to deliver the consulting piece. And that was, I think, an interesting approach. You also have an opportunity, especially in healthcare, I think you need to have key opinion leaders that are going to support you very early on. You would be surprised as an entrepreneur that you can just go out to people and say, hey, I have this idea. What do you think about it? We have put all our money and effort into this, so it better works. So you have skin in the game, and you will be surprised by how the community, in some cases, is going to help you if you find the right advisors, the right key opinion leaders that are going to become the early adopters and help you refine the product later on.
Can you tell me a little bit more about where you landed today in terms of product development and product messaging and just the current suite of solutions you offer? You mentioned in the intro generally that you're providing these technology services. When you approach customers today, what is the offering and who's your ideal customer persona?
Let me start first with the two customer personas that we have, or the two customer segments that we have. The platform can be used by many different stakeholders, but today is primarily licensed by pharmaceutical companies. And in the pharmas, you have AI teams that are developing new solutions to develop digital precision medicine, to do analysis on large amount of data, or even to run clinical studies. So our customer persona is one of the above, depending on the service or the use case that you have. So AI analysis is going to be AI teams, medical teams within a pharma company that are looking at the results of the data that they have gathered as part of a clinical study. For a clinical study, we are going to provide an electronic data capturing system that both a CRO and the sponsor, the pharma, are going to be able to use as the means to collect the data. And also you have market access teams, medical teams, that are going to be able to look at the data to refine their commercial value proposition. So you have a segment and multiple personas that are all connecting to the same database, but with different purposes. That's one persona. It took years to develop. We started with the analysis part, and then we developed into the clinical studies part, and then these more broader commercial teams. On the clinical side, the ideal customer is actually the physician or even a physician researcher. So our platform today, and I didn't go into the details, but one version of the platform is certified as a medical device for the European and the US market. We have FDA clearance since 2022 and EU approval for the platform to be used in clinical use. And that means that it can be sitting side by side with a physician. So the use case are primarily three. First, when you have collected all the data and the data is in the platform, it's going to enable you to identify patient populations that fulfill some criteria. Let's say that you have a large clinic, you have multiple physicians, each of them is defining different metrics to take decisions of patients. You can go through very quickly through the database and look for the patients that could benefit from a specific type of treatment or that you have to more closely monitor. It's also a tool to support, with a combination of AI algorithms, some level of ambient AI for decision making. So we want to provide a solution that is bringing the information to you. You don't have to look for all the data if you don't need to. So it's a very simple, here is the biomarker, here is the thing that you have to look at. So a physician can basically take a couple of seconds to take a decision. And the last part is about patient engagement. It's an area that we are developing more recently because we believe that the ultimate goal, or what is going to change in the next couple of years, is that the patients are going to be much more tech savvy and much more involved in their own healthcare and treatment of chronic diseases. For instance, and it's very simple to explain, imagine if you have a patient that needs to get an injection in the eye preventively to ensure that they are not going to lose their eyesight. They are not going to suffer this loss, but you need to convince them that they need to come every month or every 2 months to get that injection in the eye. So the best way is to involve them in the process. And this, if predictive, these four pieces of patient involvement in healthcare, we are providing the right framework to make sure that you as a physician have the right toolboxes to make it very easy for your patients to have access to that information too.
And is that just by providing reporting or visuals that the patient can use to understand their state of disease progression and make it clear to understand where they are?
Yeah, exactly. That's one way. Or even look at the historic data, but at biomarker level. So instead of having to scroll over hundreds of OCT scans, which is like an MRI scan, but for a very small region of the eye, you can just look at the biomarkers and how they evolve. And you can post this with the time that they got treatment, because there is a direct correlation between treatment and decrease on the amount of fluid, for instance. And then the patient says, okay, so I get treatment, I have less fluid, this pathological biomarker in my eyes, I need to keep on getting treatment. Mm. Or if I get treatment, and we are working extensively in the development of clinical decision support systems, if I get treatment, the rate of progression of the disease is going to slow down, for instance, for geographic atrophy. So the central vision is going to be affected, instead of in 5 years, in 10 years. And this is because I'm taking the drug on these periodic timings. So that becomes a very good engagement tool for the clinic. The physicians and patients see value.
Yeah, and between these customer personas, both within pharma, and you mentioned different user groups, and on the clinical side, do you have any customer success stories or case studies you can share about how the solution works in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I have two in mind. One specifically for pharma that makes me very happy. We need to go back to 2018. At that time, we were still developing the early days of the platform. So we had a pilot agreement with a pharmaceutical company that they were just testing our technology. And one day they just came to us, and then they had to look at significant amounts of data. And then, because the platform was there, because we had made the effort to repatriate the data from these different locations around the world, because the data was ready, we could deploy our AI models pretty much over the next couple of days over very large amounts of data. And we are talking about tens, if not hundreds of thousands of patient files. It's impossible for a human to go through that large amount of data in a reasonable amount of time. And because the quality of the output of our AI algorithms had already been tested, we could already assess these new data sets very quickly. And we could put a team to understand what was going on in that specific analysis. And the time to decision was reduced from 6 months to 6 weeks, including all the operational steps that are beyond the analysis of the data. So that actually was the end of the year. That decision came before the end of the year to the table, so they could just refine the budget for the next year. So they were able to more quickly react in light of the hard facts. The alternative was a human, teams of humans spending large sums of money in order to get the same outcome. So I'm very proud of this one, because it showed that we were gaining in terms of speed and granularity, and it was also cost savings. So all in all, this is what you wish for your product. So I'm very happy that we managed to get that project rolling, and that actually was the beginning of a very multi-year licensing agreement. That for pharma, and we continue developing clinical studies, digital precision medicine. Another one which is very close to my heart is that is in collaboration with a clinic. They were testing the software, this is not even 4 months ago, as part of a pilot, just to assess whether it was useful for them for the process of decision making. So they selected something in between 150 to 300 patients. They put them in the platform, and they specified some search criteria that were arbitrarily defined by the head of the clinic. And what they found is that in 5 to 10% of the cases, the patients had to be reassessed. And that means that for these 10%, 5 to 10%, that's 5 to 15 patients, we actually improved their eyesight. Mm. We gave them an opportunity to get the right treatment at the right time, because the specifics of the decisions had changed. So they were called back into the clinic, they were properly treated, and this was very good, because it's one-to-one impact to improving patients' lives with a regulatory approved product that can be sitting in the clinic, and it's just very tangible outcome. And now I'm very happy to announce that they are just moving forward with full licensing of the platform, because they see that this is the new standard of care that they want to offer to their patients. And that was the whole reason why we created the company in the first place, to bring the best solutions available to the people who need it the most.
So I think what's really exciting about what you're doing is there's companies within healthcare that are focused on improving frontline clinical decision-making, and there's plenty of work to do there. just to help the core mechanics of healthcare work better, right? And you think about physician burnout and scheduling and all this stuff, and it matters. It matters a lot. But in addition to that, our bodies are so complex that there are many disease states that we don't have a good understanding of the underlying biology. And without advancing on the research side, we'll never achieve what we can to reduce the disease burden. And it's also very easy to forget, as a healthy person, a very privileged one, of the myriad experiences that people and patients have, especially those suffering from these chronic conditions that need more investment. And so you're providing these solutions on the research side as well to try to recouple clinical research to care, which I think is really inspiring and meaningful. Related to this, can we talk about your recent partnership with the Retina Consultants of America? Because that's a pretty significant real-world evidence partnership, right?
Yes. So what we are trying to do here, maybe before, let me just take a step back to explain the origin of the partnership. We are sometimes very frustrated, and many healthcare stakeholders are frustrated because it's very difficult to understand the outcomes when you try something in a clinical study that has performance value, and then you bring it to the clinic, and then that performance value may differ on different patient populations, a different diversity groups, different individuals that were included or excluded of a clinical study. And real-world evidence and real-world data is helping you better understand what is the impact of your drug outside a controlled clinical trial and a controlled environment. We had been working with Retina Consultants of America for a while in multiple research initiatives, and then we saw this opportunity that they are one of the largest retina clinic networks in the United States. They have clinical data, they have multiple clinics that they are serving. They want to provide the best care to their patients. And at the same time, we have a very powerful engine that enables you to digest data at scale and deploy AI analysis on top. So we said, let's just join forces to offer the most comprehensive real-world evidence database in the United States. Let's just put together all the insights that you have, different patient populations. We are going to pass them through the engine, and we are going to extract statistics about what are the best drugs for these specific patients, which patient populations can benefit the most. And this is a wealth of knowledge that is going to inform the next process of decision-making for the drug makers, for the payers, for anybody who is making considerations on what is the impact that a drug really has on some specific patient population. So I'm really proud about this one. And it's a massive partnership. Of course, when it comes to operations, you have hundreds of clinics. Every clinic has a different IT system. Every IT system has different setups. So it's a major undertaking, but I think that by working together and just being true to your goals of just getting to the facts and being able to test hypotheses, we are going to make it.
So I want to take a step back and go a little deeper on the core technology, right? So you just mentioned the engine, and I think it's interesting to think about the why now question with a startup at a company, right? What are the underlying technologies that make it possible for Icarion to do what it does today as it relates to cloud and AI and machine learning? Like, what is it about this moment in time that enables your company to do what it's doing?
I would say that there is the underlying infrastructure that enables you to scale. And I'm very happy to say that we are working closely with Amazon to make sure that our infrastructure is able to scale depending on the customer needs. There are a lot of microservices that are going to make your life easier because somebody has already taken care of solving those challenges for you. Discovery is composed of, I would say, four islands. There is an image and data management system. That is the engine, the brain behind the scenes, that is just making sure that all the processes, all the data is properly collected. There is the ability to manage tasks, process data, organize it, properly structure it, making it, it's the funneling into the proper structure. Then we have a certified clinical viewer, which is what is certified. We have FDA clearance, NDR approval as well for the platform. It's another part of the platform, and you can change those or update those. So with the current regulatory frameworks, you can just basically use the same brain for different purposes and then have a certified front end that you can change. And you can just very quickly connect through APIs of communication. You have an ever-growing number of AI modules that because of the architecture of the platform, you can just almost deploy like Lego blocks. You just put it on top, input and output, and it becomes like another piece or another source of knowledge for whatever data is coming in. And last but not least, you have collaborative tools and also the necessary tools to ensure GDPR, HIPAA, PIPEDA compliance in Canada. So is this for islands that are developing in parallel and that technology now with third-party software libraries or libraries that we have built ourselves, now it's the moment because people's mind is already ready too. Because sometimes what it happens is that you have a new innovation. You are really excited because that innovation is going to change the world. But if the application layer is not the right one, you're going to be sitting on a great innovation that is not going to be where adoption is not going to be at the rate that you expect. And for a startup, that is a massive risk. So I would say that innovation is not as important as education and the application layer that you bring. So user experience is everything. I think that user experience and education is now ready for many therapeutic areas and areas in healthcare. And it was for us, but it has taken a long time.
Mm-hmm. Now is the time indeed. I want to shift gears a little bit and reflect on your journey and things you've learned. Let's start with funding. So, you know, earlier you were telling me about starting off out of the PhD project, the initial science. We really focused on ophthalmology, but that ultimately there was a broader story to be told. And when you're speaking with investors, really at the earliest stages, they're looking at team and TAM, right? Like how big is the market if everything goes well? And then do we have confidence in this team that they're going to be able to execute against it? And of course, VC is not the only source of early stage capital. They are the ones who get paid to lose money. So friends and family can be a little bit more risky. And then also there's non-dilutive funding sources. But can you tell us about your story as it relates to fundraising and engaging with sources of capital? And it'd be best if you had some mistakes you made along the way, because as this is a really difficult thing for all founders in our space.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for us, I could tell you about the early beginnings, and I think it's a good story to tell. We came out of our PhDs, Sandro, Stefanos, and I. We were doing our PhDs together. We had some savings, literally not much. And whatever savings we had, we used it to create a company. We put all our savings in the company, and actually we had to put money over and over again. So the first year was a bit eating noodles and literally not going out for... We had skin in the game, and this is something that our first investors value, because this, the thinking I would say for an investor was, okay, these guys are all in, they have put all their money into this, so skin in the game, check. Team, they are putting all their time into making this work. Dan, let's just see about that, because they still need to figure out, as I said, the business model. But that was the main funding that we had the first year. And I think I can tell a nice story. I think we are lucky because in Switzerland, you have a lot of opportunities as an organization company coming out from university grassroots to tap into early sources of funding or other initiatives that are going to put you in the spotlight, because that's what you want to be, in the spotlight. So people see what you're doing, so people can get to know you. So we had one of these trips, roadshows organized by an entity here called Venture Lab, which is a private institution with some public funding. They organized a roadshow to Boston. I prepared for a presentation of 3 minutes. And then just before jumping on the scenario, they told me, remember, it's 1 minute. So I had to compress a 3 minute presentation into 1 minute. And back then I was not as, I haven't gone through too many rodeos, so I tried to do it at the speed of light, and that didn't look well. It was a disaster. And actually, there was one investor in the audience who got with our presentation and reached out and said, I think I've witnessed one of the worst presentations in my life, but I think there is something in there. Let's just sit down and talk. And then a couple of months after that, so that was May, a couple of months after that, that investor actually decided to invest in the pre-seed round of the company. So that was, he actually saved the day because we were running out of money, not even to buy noodles anymore. So that was early sources of funding. And then afterwards, we raised convertible loans, is these magic terms, from friends and family, as we saw that the company was getting some traction, getting some additional customers. We closed our first investment, pre-Series A, in 2019, then Series A along the way, and just 2 months ago, we closed our Series A extension. And so it has been, at the beginning, especially friends and family and people who believed in us because we had all the skin in the game. And I think we have evolved because what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. There were difficult times, and as a startup entrepreneur, you're going to suffer. But guess what? Sometimes you just make it through and you just figure out what the business model is, what the licensing is, what is the right value for the customer, what you have to jump away from with micro pivoting. Yeah, so difficult, a lot of luck, but you need to be there to have the luck. You need to be on the spotlight to and present to be able to get the early sources of funding.
And you have to be convicted. If you don't believe in your company, why should anybody else believe in your company?
And
you demonstrated that, right, through bootstrapping. So you and I recently became fathers, and we're talking about startup here, but compared to other journeys in life, it certainly isn't the most important one and certainly not the most demanding. But how has becoming a father changed how you operate as an entrepreneur?
First, I have a daughter. She's called Sophia. It's the best thing in my life. It has turned my world upside down in a good way. It has changed perspective. I didn't realize how much time it was going to take. So we always have this naive bias. And I think this is just my personality and personality of many entrepreneurs, that how difficult can it be? And it is indeed difficult. Many people go through it, but it has been a journey, especially the first day, the first couple of months. It was really about changing the perspective, making sure that I was there for my wife, just making sure that I was there to take care of the little one at home. And that meant that I had to become smarter on how I was managing my time with the startup and how I was delegating. In a way, I think that this, in retrospect, was good for the company, because as an entrepreneur, you need to learn how to let go and focus where you have to focus and delegate everything else that doesn't require your time. But Jesus, it was difficult. First couple of days, learning about not to sleep at night, learning about how to take time, because those moments only come once in a lifetime. And you need to also know what is the most important thing in life for you. For me, it's my daughter and my family, and it has always been, but I didn't really know up to which extent. So really happy. I think for other entrepreneurs and for other startup founders out there, I just think it's about having your values right. Family is very important. They're going to be there 20 years from now. The people who will remember where you were is actually your family, so you better be there. Those moments only come once. I'm difficult. We manage. We learn. But what doesn't kill you, again, in a startup world, is the same as in personal life, and makes you stronger. So pretty happy.
I think the key insight there is it's a forcing function for delegation. And ultimately, as a leader, you have to learn how to scale and how to push decision-making away from you and closer to customers, right? Because as you grow and the team grows, less and less actually about the underlying operating rhythms of the business. And if you do know everything about the underlying operating rhythms of the business, that comes at the trade-off of not having a compelling 3 to 5 year vision, which you need to motivate people to join and to keep them moving forward and motivated and engaged. And that's a very difficult transition for everybody to go through. But if you've got this little crying, wrinkly, pink, warm bundle of joy most of the time that's screaming for you, it makes that decision quite immediate indeed. Carlos, this has been so much fun. When we wrap up and we're both getting ready to go into the weekend and you're reflecting on this conversation, what question are you going to wish I had asked you?
I would say, based on my experience, what do I think are the best soft skills to have in order to become an entrepreneur? I think that's always a good one. I think that one would be an interesting one. I can answer
it. Yeah, and the fun thing is now you get to answer it.
Yes. I think resilience. Do not give up. That's actually what, or learn how to define your boundaries and give it all in. Do not do it halfway. Do or do not. Paraphrasing Yoda's way of thinking, but do not give up. In our case, there are three mantras. We do not give up. We do not bend, and we will endure. And repeating that to yourself, hardening, and you need to suffer a bit to harden. So it's good that you suffer on the early days, especially of a startup, that you are trapping with not enough money to make really much investments, because that is going to rewire your thinking. You are going to be a lot more conscious on how you are spending every single dollar or every single euro or Swiss franc that you have. You need to educate everyone, yourself and everyone around you, to suffer a bit, because some of the best ideas come because of that early suffering. And resilience is something that you can build over time. Some people have it in them. When you struggle a bit and you learn, because so basically it's all about failing and learning about your failures and integrating them in your next decision. That's all. And being a bit lucky too.
And being a bit lucky too. Carlos, thank you so much for joining me today on the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. This was really a joy.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. It was great talking to you and looking forward to speaking again soon.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.